Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming to this session straight after lunch. Hopefully everyone isn't too full and can stay awake. And if everything goes to plan, we will have a few questions at the end. Sometimes these combined scheme updates do run a little bit tight, so hopefully we'll have time. If we do, can we please use the microphones in the centre, since these are recorded sessions, and that way we capture all the questions so that for prosperity. We've got two sections today. We've got the NDIA and then WA My Way. We'll start off with NDIA. There'll be two presenters, Kim Birch and Sarah Johnson. Sarah is the scheme actuary, and we've now seen several times in the context of the conference.
That's a positive.
That's absolutely a positive. So I won't go into too many details on her in the interest of time, but she's the one... Kim joined the National Disability Insurance Agency in 2014, leading the Hunter New South Wales trial of the NDIS. Kim has many years' experience in personal injury and disability insurance schemes in both private and public sector organisations. Most recently, Kim has been working with the NDIA teams on scheme design and the operating model to transition an additional 430,000 people with a disability to the NDIS. Kim and Sarah.
Thank you very much for having us here today. It's a bit of a change for me. I think last time I was here, I was presenting on the CTP scheme in Queensland, so this is a bit of a change. Just a little bit of background. Sarah covered a lot of this morning. Is anybody not in Sarah's session this morning? Okay, just for you in the back row. We will be quick. We only have 15. But it's important to understand the role of the agency. We're a statutory authority to administer the scheme. The big P stuff happens with the Commonwealth, big P policy setting with the Commonwealth, with the states and territories. And we have a little P. We're allowed to play in that space of operational policy. It's a product out of the Productivity Commission, and just a bit about our workforce at the moment. We have around 854 staff, and over 16% identify as having disability. We're very happy with that. Our target was 16 and we've passed that, so we're on our way. And 50% of our staff identify as having lived experience of disability. So that's somebody in their life with a disability, or they have in excess of 3 years' experience of working with people with disability. It's very comforting over these last 2 days, hearing a lot of these scheme updates and some of the factors that of success in an organisation, that we're ticking some boxes on these things. So it's been very, very comforting to know that we're on the right path. Just a little bit of history prior to the launch. Now, I put this up because it's not a blah. This is really important because it's the fundamental about the integrity of our scheme and how we operate. It's coming from a place of the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disability, and that's embedded in our legislation. And then the National Disability Strategy. Sarah mentioned this morning. I put this here for a reason, because it outlines the commitment of all levels of government to supporting people with disability to live what we call a good life, an ordinary life. And the main factors of that is inclusion in life. So these are the key domains and priority areas. And the success of this scheme is everybody's accountability and responsibility. The agency is but a small part of the bigger pie. And we know that, and it requires everyone to get on board to support this scheme. We talk about the pillars that underpin the NDIS. These pillars are also our goals in our scheme. The insurance approach, which means all those usual things about investing for the long, long term, thinking about how you can reduce the lifetime cost trajectory for... by particular interventions. It's about being person-centred, outcomes-focused, and working from an evidence base as we can, and also building that evidence base. Choice and control, it's one of the underpinning parts of the UN Rights of People with Disability. And choice and control is quite a challenging thing for us, and for people within the scheme. When I say us, I talk about our community when I say us. I've learned a lot of things leaving accident compensation schemes and moving into the disability sector, and I think it's quite pleasing to know that. But when you talk about choice and control, this is a real challenge that we will build on with our participants over the coming years. It's about how they become consumers and how they really do exercise their right to choose and what that means for them. And the challenges they have now with the provider world that's available to them or where they've come from, and understanding what real choice and control really means. Making those, there's really basic things here. This is about deciding when you want to have your shower and getting a provider that can come, rather than being told you can shower, you'll be showered at 2 o'clock. Okay, so be there. So big changes, and they're really fundamental things that you and I probably take for granted, but it's quite empowering to see a participant realise that and their eyes light up and realise that I actually can make those choices myself. So I'm going to look around. I'm going to find another provider. So it's not until we actually see participants really realising this and that we will see probably the real change up in the market responding to it. But it's very, very powerful. And community and mainstream. This scheme has been established to coexist with other funding mechanisms. And so there are a number of systems that need to play their part and fund what they're required to fund. And that's that mainstream funding for housing, education, justice, health and those sorts of things. The other part about it is community and mainstream is that we know that if you can support a participant to actually develop real social inclusion, not a provider taking you to the shops inclusion, but real social inclusion of making friends in your community and from your community, the opportunities for all of that informal support, risk, safeguarding happens naturally within that environment. And so we've invested in our model of service delivery around these three pillars. How things have changed. You've probably seen this slide before because I saw it 2 years ago when I was at this conference. So we might update this one. Yes. But basically we're moving from block funding schemes that had limitations on what they could fund, wait lists, to a real person-centred and outcomes-focused schemes. Sarah showed this one this morning, so I won't show it again. But we are looking at delivering in local communities. We will establish sites across the country. We'll have big offices and little offices. We'll look at co-locating where we can. And we're looking at leveraging how we can actually embed ourselves within community. And the exciting thing, I think, for this scheme and when I think about working for us as a regulator and within the CTP system for so long and the bad days of trying to bring systems together and actually get a common definition of road, I think this is such an opportunity to build a system that indeed supports participants to live anywhere in the country and expect to get the same service. You know, we talked about McDonald's being Switzerland. Well, we're hoping we're building some of the features of McDonald's as well, and that's the real power of this as well. The insurance principles we've talked about. But it's about, look, we've been through this many times and this is probably an audience that's very familiar with all of this. We use this for other things as well, but it is absolutely embedded in how we operate. Within our trial sites to date, we teach staff what reasonable and necessary means. We teach staff how you evaluate whether the investment's worthwhile over the lifetime and how you calculate that. There's lifetime cost estimators, tools that we can use. And how we go up, what's value for money and how you'd go about doing that. The things that we fund in plans are directly related to the participants' goals and objectives. And we're teaching our staff on what that means, you know, and how you flip those and twist those around and bring them around to having an economic and social participation focus. But as I was saying, I was talking to Greg Taylor before, earlier, who I haven't seen for a while, that the things that, you know, we talk about wanting to achieve these objectives, we have people that just want to own their own key to their front door. We're coming from a very different place here. And we're spending this first 12 months in the trial. We've done a lot of work to just transition people into the scheme and fix up things, get them a wheelchair with matching wheels, deal with their continence aid products, and just get them into the scheme. We've learnt that people can spend a lot of time wanting to develop that perfect my plan, that very perfect plan. That, and as Suzanne said this morning, was that today? It can take hours and hours and hours to do that. But rather than try and getting things perfect, what we've learned is if we can bring people into the scheme and settle them into the scheme, give them the supports during that time for them to settle in, they can then get ready and be more prepared for the next time. And we talk about this being just the start of the journey. This is not it. This is a very mud map of what we do, but essentially we meet people, we talk about what their needs are, we look at the evidence, we look about their hope, their goals and their aspirations and their capacity. We establish a plan, we fund the plan against sets of criteria. Reasonable and necessary funding and supports is very important to the integrity of the scheme and the full financial sustainability of it. We support participants to implement their plan. We ultimately review the plan and we start the cycle again. I forgot we bring people into the scheme as well. So that's our frequency and our claims costs sitting there, and our access and our plan costs sitting there. We're working on a range of things on how we keep the simple. The simpler the better. It reduces, you know, you keep it simple, reduces admin costs, it makes sense to people. We're looking at plan durations, things at the moment. You know, this whole concept of getting out of the way of people's lives, we're very, very much embedded in the way we operate, and we're working on ways that we can do that. So length of plan is one of the things we'll look at over the coming years as we head to full scheme. It's your turn.
So we thought we'd put up a little bit of data. So this is some of our 30 June 2015 information. So far, we've got 19,817 in the scheme. That's over 20,000 now. And 17,303 had an approved plan as at 30 June. In terms of the money that's gone into the plan, some of which is spent, some of which will be spent in the future, is $952.8 million. So we now are over that $1 billion mark. And our participant satisfaction is high, and that's satisfaction with the agency processes, and it's at 95%, and it's been there for a little while now. There's a little bit more detail on our participants and the trial sites that Kim went through. I won't go through that in detail, but we do need to meet our bilateral targets, and you can see there in terms of the number of people that are in at 30 June, we're over the target, and we're almost there with the number of people on an approved plan. So there you can also see that some of our trial sites are doing things in different ways. So New South Wales is over the 3 years is phasing over three LGAs. And if I can get this pointer to work, I can. So you can see there that you've still got a lot of new people coming into the scheme in the recent months. And these lighter lines are where we're reviewing people's plans. So some people are on their second and third plans. South Australia, we're ramping up there. Whereas Victoria, we got a lot of people in at the start, and we're still seeing people come in, but we're focusing more on reviewing plans in Victoria. Tassie, for the sake of having the scale the same, it's all the way down here, but once again, we got a lot in at the start, and we're seeing a few extra trickle in. Similarly, these are our new trial sites that started in 2014. The NT, I'll point out, you can see here we got some in right at the start. Then we've worked very hard to improve our community engagement over here. So June we got quite a big number in, and actually the last quarter we got another 30 in or so, so up to about 100. But you can see there that we took quite a few months to increase the awareness of the scheme and build that trust in order to bring people in. So just in terms of our participants, there you can see you're best to focus on the blue and the purple bars in here, but we do have a lot of kids, so quite a big proportion are in the 0 to 14 category, and less so in some of the other age groups. Obviously, they've got five more years in it, but even so, we've got a big focus on kids in the scheme. You can see there we're pretty in line with what we had expected, slightly more kids on a distributional basis, that is, but that might change as we get more experience in. Gender, we do have more males than females in the scheme. Some of that's driven by autism is a good example, but you can see they're largely in line with what we would have expected. Indigenous status. For the trial sites that commenced in 2014, we're actually fairly on par with what we'd expect. Obviously, a very big number in the Northern Territory. we're a bit lower than what we would expect in these trial sites, but we've also improved our data collection, so that's sort of going up because of the improved reporting. But we do have some little work to do here in terms of engaging with Indigenous communities. And it's similar with cows. The cows largely in line for some of the new trial sites, but we're a little bit behind in some of these trial sites, with the exception of South Australia, which is kids. A lot of people ask what are the sorts of participants that we have in our scheme. So I've just put New South Wales and Victoria up there. They've been in place for 2 years and they're all ages, 0 to 65. So autism and intellectual disability are our biggest groups. We've got some psychosocial disability in there and cerebral palsy as well. In the kids, you see some developmental delay and global developmental delay, but they're some of the key disabilities. Talked a little bit before about committed support, so just under $1 billion that's gone in plans to date. And this is interesting, in terms of the distribution of package costs, we're not quite tracking how we would have expected. So we've got less people in the lower buckets, got more people in this 10 to 30 bucket, got a little bit less in this 30 to 100, and then we're pretty in line with the number that we've got over 100K at the moment. When you use all of this information, we're still tracking well in terms of the total cost of the scheme and the participants that have come in, but we're keeping an eye on this distribution to understand it a little bit more. And then in terms of the sorts of things that are going into plans, not unexpectedly, daily task shared living is a big component of the funded support, along with community participation and assistance with personal activities. It probably makes up around 70 to 75% of the support that goes in the scheme. For kids, it's different, much more in the early childhood therapeutic support space. And Tassie, where it's 15 to 24-year-olds, got more in the community participation space at this stage. And that's all. I think you're back on.
Okay. Thank you very much. So some of our challenges to date aren't surprising, how you transition people from existing schemes into the NDIS. Just difficulty with data. I think our big one is data and getting accurate information that's up to date that we can then work from. Simon's smiling. obviously the better data we have, it's more efficient, the process. We're not spending time trying to find the right phone number and those sorts of things. So we're working on that. Well, Simon is. And also building capacity of our participants, I spoke about early, to actively participate in the planning conversation and implementation. And that's my typo, everybody, choose, sorry about that. And that choice and control. And also the legacy of existing systems. This is why some of the numbers look different. It depends how programs were initially funded gives a look of how some participants enter the scheme. Also, that's that whole unpacking of mainstream interface. There's quite some complex arrangements out there that states and territories have put in place, just simply about trying to get the right services and supports in for people. So it might be delivered by a health department, but it's actually funded by disability with a bit of money bolted on from somewhere else. So the challenges for the trials have been actually unpacking those mainstream interfaces, and that's going to be a big challenge for us going forward in the transition years, is getting that right and making sure that the agents, that their scheme continues to coexist with other funding mechanisms. And also, that's such an administrative cost. It's the friction costs of doing that. And when you look particularly at health and the different local hospital networks that operate across the country, I'm quite nervous about that one. But we will do it. And that, talking about just from a provider perspective, moving from block funding to invoicing, I think that's been quite a challenging environment for providers to think about what that means. And sometimes the CEO's got it, but the admin department hasn't. So it's just helping those providers and supporting providers to come with us on the journey, and also for them also to think outside the box on how they go about how they might offer services. And it's pleasing to see across the country that I've sat in on presentations by providers, and they're already there. Some of the things they're doing are beating what's going on in the trial sites, so that's really promising to see. Our task ahead, this is our challenge, is to bring this number of participants into the scheme. So to do that and sleep at night, we've devised a cunning plan. Problem with this is that we don't make the choices about how people enter the scheme. This is a product, an output of the state and territory negotiations with the Commonwealth on who will enter the scheme and at what time, and what that cohort mix looks like. So our job is to operationalise this. So we work out how we're going to do it, and then we have to tweak when we look at the challenges coming our way. So we developed we think of the scheme in phases. We've been in trial. We're moving to transition for the next 3 years. And so we went back to basics and had a look at the good fundamentals. We had a look at understanding our participant characteristics, a lot of the stuff like the TAC was talking about yesterday. We've understood it's not necessarily the characteristics of the participants. In our world, it's about the environment and the circumstances that they live in and things that are going on around them rather than particularly a diagnosis. So we've had a good look at that. We've looked at volumes and channels and how they will connect with us. We've validated that against 1,500 records, and we're looking to use proxy data coming through from the states and territories to stream participants into different service response. That's about making sure we're investing our administrative resources in the right place at the right time. We're looking at online. We're looking at getting out of the way. It fitted nicely with what I heard yesterday too. It's nice, pleasing when things line up. But we do want to get out of the way. We know there's participants out there that really don't need us to help them. And so we want to build a system that enables them to do that. And so we're working on that. We're looking at, we've identified the participants that were really suitable for local area coordinators to be their primary connection point with the agency, absolutely embedded in their community, people that really know those local communities, know what those connections look like. And then we've identified a cohort that really, really requires what we're calling, I hate the word specialised, if someone's got a better word, I'd like that, specialised planners that do indeed can understand how you unpack all those mainstream interface connections, what health should fund, justice system and those things, people that don't have a voice or have anyone who is a real voice for them, and how we invest in that group as well. So they each have different responses aligned with where we think we get our return on investment across those streams. The reference packages and outcomes framework Sarah talked about this morning, so I won't go any further. And that's the final bit. Transitioning to full scheme will be our challenge, but we're up for it. And we are truly an agency that listens, learns, builds and delivers. So we have this, we expect we'll be awash with data coming through, and we will continue evolving and tweaking until we get it right.
So the next section is on WA My Way. So we've got two presenters here. Alan Greenfield, who, for those of you who were there at last night, was presented with the Institute's Actor of the Year 2015 award. Alan is the founding director of Taylor Fry with more than 25 years of experience in general insurance and accident compensation. He leads the actuarial team that carries out the valuation of the New Zealand social welfare system, and he is a principal actuary to both the CTP scheme and National Disability Insurance Scheme in Western Australia. The second speaker on WA My Way is Simone Spencer. Simone joined the Disability Services Commission in September 2014 on secondment from the WA Department of the Premier and Cabinet as Executive Director of Planning in the Commission's Reformative Directorate. Simone's team oversaw all intergovernmental and intra-agency engagement for the Commission and focus on options development and modelling for the future of disability service provision in WA.
All right, hello. Now, I'll see if I can race through this because I think we've only got about 15 minutes left. This is my first injury seminar. And it's been very interesting. And when Alan invited us to come, I thought, well, what do we talk about? And he said, well, you might want to start with what is my way because people probably haven't heard about it before. So that's where we're going to start. Why my way? So you might be aware that we're running two comparative trials of the NDIS in WA. NDIS My Way, which is run in the Lower South West and the red there, and in Cobourne, Kwinana, with the NDIA NDIS trial site in the Perth Hills. So why the comparative trial? And I think a lot of people take from the name My Way, it's just that WA wanted to do it its own way, which is true most of the time, but actually there's a very good reason for it being called My Way. So, well, WA has a very long history probably a very different history to other jurisdictions with regard to disability service provision. So well before the NDIS and the politics that came with that, we had already started implementing individualised funding. The Commission has about 90% of all funds that it sends out to the community under individualised funding arrangements. We've also got a local area coordinator network that we've sort of developed over about 25 years. And over that period of time, we've tried lots and lots of different models as to how that network is best executed in the community. We've had it in-house, we've had it with providers, we've had it with different organisations. So we've tried lots of models and refined it. We've also got quite a lot of self-management and shared management arrangements and are quite a... I think a nation-leading, particularly around shared management practice of individuals and families being given the capacity to manage their own funds. And I think Alan will talk a little bit later about how that is quite characterised, particularly in our Lower South West trial site. We've invested significantly in WA in our sector. We have a very mature relationship with our disability services sector. We acknowledge that the sector largely comes from organisations that were born out of mums and dads wanting to sort of start something for either family members or friends. And so we've invested in those organisations understanding themselves as sovereign entities and what it means to develop service models and effectively price those service models. So over the past 5 years, the state government has pumped $600 million into our disability sector. And really, that's about ensuring quality services, building thin markets, and also looking at how those organisations can, instead of living week to week, month to month, actually build the capacity of those organisations from a governance perspective. So, and I'll use the words of Bruce Bonahady, who's visited us quite a few times, obviously the chair of the NDIA. In WA, the NDIS was very much more an evolution than a revolution for the way in which we deliver disability services. So where did the My Way thing come from? Well, as I said, we've got a 25-year history of local area coordination. And that actually evolved in 2012 to individual planning. So again, before the NDIS came about, people were saying, okay, well, we actually want to plan in a goal and strategy way, so very similar to what the NDIS has ended up looking like. And so we had four My Way project sites. The name obviously came from people in the sector, and it was supposed to capture the notion of not only do we get individualised funding, but now we can actually have fully individualised planning connected to that funding as well. So, and that, as I said, that was an evolution of our local area coordinator program. Now, our My Way sites prior NDIS were Cobourne, Kwinana, Perth Hills, Lower South West and Goldfields. So when we actually agreed with the Commonwealth Government that we would run a comparative trial, we utilised those project sites as the catalyst for our NDIS trial sites, so the Perth Hills being one of them. So most everybody who is in the NDIA, NDIS trial in the Perth Hills already had a My Way plan. So I suppose the key characteristics of My Way, in addition to what I've already mentioned, is there was very, very strong focus on the role of the My Way coordinator, and that coordinator very much being a wrangler, I think is the term we like to use, for individuals and families, so that they can understand not just what funded supports and providers are available to them, but what might be available in their community. One of the key characteristics of the WA model is that it's very, we already have quite a significant information linkages and capacity building component. We have lots of people have significant unfunded strategies in their plans. And we feel like they complement the funded strategies within people's plans and really drive toward better community connection We find that people don't necessarily want a world full of service providers. They just want a world full of community connection and what the rest of us expect within our lives. So we often find that independent role of the My Way coordinator enables them to get a better balance in their plan, and it's not just front-ended with service provider supports. So it's also, and this is really quite critical for those of you who've been to WA, it's suitable for metro, country and regional. It is quite interesting sometimes when we have intergovernmental meetings and people are talking about the regional remote issues in Ballarat, and we say, well, we've got something a bit further away than that. So we've obviously invested for about a quarter of a century in what works in really, really remote WA, and often you just have to be incredibly opportunistic, and the wranglers are sometimes the people that you least expect, but they might be who, in an Aboriginal community, those families trust, and we've used to brokering arrangements through those people. So it's about being ultimately flexible and realising that you have pretty much zero market in those areas, and we have to leverage quite significantly off mainstream services, and having that really close partnership is something that the Commission has worked on for a really long time, so with organisations like Department of Housing and Health. I sort of mentioned really that NDIS My Way, and unfortunately the NDIS gets dropped off more often than not when people talk about My Way. It's fully integrated into the national scheme rules, so what you get in reasonable and necessary in WA is what you should expect in Victoria. So full portability, same eligibility, and the same principles that are articulated in the Act are the same as in NDIS My Way. We're really just, the focus is a different operational model on the ground, and one that we believe is a bit more intensively focused on the relationship around planning and the fact that planning can take a long time, and often people want that continuity of relationship from the beginning of the planning process all the way through to the delivery of that plan. So I'll hand over to Alan, leave you 5 minutes to race through your slides.
It's lucky we don't have any. Okay. Thanks, Simone. All right, so I'm not sure if you got from all of that, but the NDIS My Way trials have only been going for just over a year. So unlike Sarah, we don't have the length of history of data to show you. Also, there's only two relatively small trial sites compared to the national scheme, so it's a lot fewer participants involved at this stage. So the chart on the left shows you that there are at the moment 1,800 thereabouts participants in the in NDIS My Way. Of those, about 1,400 transferred from the previous project that Simone was telling you about, My Way, the previous incarnation. As well as that, there are something like 400 new participants. Of those, about 125 are psychosocial disorders. So they're newly eligible under the NDIS rules that weren't sort of eligible in the previous My Way project, whereas the other 250 physical and intellectual new participants would have been eligible previously, but perhaps for funding reasons didn't get weren't being funded in the previous project. The current average committed plan cost for annual amount is about $29,500, shown there. You can see the distribution of those plans. The number is the blue bars, so most plans are in the $10,000 to $30,000 range, although the cost sort of heads up towards those over 100,000, the bulk of the cost. In terms of the planning process, as Simone said, it's the same rules as the NDIS. This first chart on the left shows you the eligibility process goes consent. They accept the form, then there's an eligibility assessment, then the planning stage, approval, and then once a plan's approved, and then they can start making payments. So this slide just shows the length of time between those last two stages, so the plan approval and then first payment. So you can see that the majority of payments are made within the first month or two of plan approval. Now the second chart shows what proportion of plans are achieving their goals. Now these are plans that are completed plans, and obviously at December 14, none of the plans could have been in place for more than 6 months because these were, they couldn't have been in place for more than 6 months under the NDIS My Way. They were transferred from the previous project, so there are some numbers there that are probably not representative. But the last two bars show you that about 90% of plans are achieving their goals. Okay, the last two charts we have for you. These are around sort of funding strategies, self-management and support types. On the left, you can see that the WA scheme has a high proportion of strategies which are self-managed. And so it's about that middle bar shows 40% of strategies are self-managed, but they only constitute about 15% of the funding. So it gives you an idea that lots of the smaller strategies are being self-managed, which makes a lot of sense, really. In the second chart, I guess the thing that stands out most is that for accommodation support, which only account for about 2% of strategies, have a very large 25% proportion of the cost of the funding. So just shows you the high cost of providing funding for accommodation. The reverse is true for equipment, I guess. Some of the equipment is relatively cheap, although I know my sister was very pleased to get a hearing aid in Canberra from the NDIS, and I know it was bloody expensive. That's all I had for you. There is a lot more statistics along the lines of what Sarah was showing in the quarterly report, so there are characteristics. It shows you numbers of participants by the various characteristics, gender, disability, type, age, etc. And those are available online on DSC's website. So I think we've left you with 30 seconds, maybe.
So that was the bell outside, so unfortunately we haven't got any time for questions, but I just want to thank all four members of the panel again for providing us that insights and information on what's happening in Western Australia. We on the Eastern Seaboard obviously sometimes get a little bit of criticism, but we are interested in what everyone is doing out there. Feedback. Can everyone please fill out the forms? I've presented at other conferences, and I can tell you that we all like to know how people thought we went, where we could improve. So if you could please provide those feedback, but I'm sure all the panelists will be really appreciative of that. Other than that, just maybe one last thank you.